this is Alexander Jones Live. Today, Thursday the 7th of March. On this edition, we promise an election-free zone. This is the only mention of student elections that I will guarantee you will hear during this programme before the end. So what will we be doing today? Well, we'll be talking in a moment to the Associate Chief Information Officer for the University, Dr. Kevin Donaghy. He's here with us in the studio, and I'll be asking him about IT systems in just a second. And later in the hour, Tahir Aslam from the Islamic Society will join me live in the studio. That's all here on Alexander Jones Live. And don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter if you don't already do so. I'm at Mr. Jones News. We can easily take it for granted, but university IT systems are at the heart of the student life. They may only be noticeable when they break, however, a lot of effort goes into keeping the systems running. And today on this programme, I'm joined by Kevin Donaghy, the Associate Chief Information Officer here at the university. Welcome to the programme, Kevin.
Thanks a lot, Alexander.
So how well do you think the university currently do IT then?
I think we have got significantly better in the past few years. There's been large investment by the university in staffing, resources and equipment. I think things have got significantly better than they were probably 3 or 4 years ago.
Is that they were in quite a bad place a few years ago then?
I think it had become quite moribund. Technology had moved along. The university hadn't exactly kept up with it. Services weren't being delivered to the expectations of the customers. St Andrews is a particularly prestigious institute, and as you might expect, people who came here expected very high standards in IT, and I don't think we were always meeting those standards.
And do you think that you're now meeting those standards?
I think we're working towards them. We've had some very positive feedback from students and staff about the improvements that we've put in place. It's an ongoing process. We're always catching new technology and trying to improve on what we're doing. But I think we're more comfortable now than we were before.
What are the specific challenges that you face in actually trying to maintain and improve the IT system constantly?
I think there are probably three main challenges for us. The first one is likely to be, and this is something that may well be hidden to most of your listeners, and that's security. Security is a constant concern for us. We also have to balance it up with things like academic freedom. In an institution like this, people want to conduct learning, they want to conduct research. Yet, on the balance, we also have to try and secure our systems because, as you may have seen, there have been in the news recently some very high-profile situations where universities in America have had their student record systems hacked and the personal details of students have been put out on the internet for anyone to see. So we have to balance up what we're doing from a security perspective with the kind of freedoms that you would want to have for your learning and research.
And have we had people attempting to breach university computer security? Are there people trying to hack into our systems here?
Yes. I mean, we're under constant attack. I mean, you may have seen recently, though most of the time our filters catch them, emails that are sent out which are called phishing emails, which ask you to go to a specific website and put in your username and password because your webmail account, for example, has reached its quota. Now, these are just attempts to get your username and password so they could then be used to send spam emails out to other institutions and other people.
But so far, no one has been successful in doing that here?
No, we have the odd situation where students or members of staff do give out the usernames and passwords. But those are very rare occasions.
What do you think could be done better to improve the student experience with IT?
That's quite a tricky one. It's something that we do constantly ask the students. I mean, we conducted a survey recently. Feedback was very good and we had a number of useful suggestions. We also had a number of complaints, which we obviously are trying to address as quickly as we can. Technology moves on. Students want to learn, study, conduct the research now almost anywhere. Previously, we expected to see students going to the library and doing their studying, but now we're seeing students saying, well, you know, I want to sit outside on the lawn when the weather's nice, and I want to sit in St Silvator's quad and study. So it's a question of how we can bring that St Andrews learning experience to them wherever they want to be.
And I suppose one of the things that would tie into that is actually making Wi-Fi available as broadly as possible.
Yeah.
What sort of options are you looking at for trying to do that for more students in more places here?
Right. I mean, we made a significant investment last year in Wi-Fi options, and now Wi-Fi is available in all halls of residence, which was, I think, made us the first university in Scotland to do that. What we've also done more recently, you may have seen a news article, we've partnered with BT so that we now have BT Wi-Fi access through all the access points in the university, so that visitors, for example, who turn up here can access the BT Wi-Fi. The next stage of that, and this is slightly longer term and requires us to work with the people like St Andrews Partnership and businesses in the town, is to look at making Wi-Fi access available in town through both BT and through St Andrews. So, for example, it would mean that potentially you could use Eduroam, the university's student Wi-Fi, from most places within St Andrews.
So that students could have free Wi-Fi in their accommodation out by Morrison's?
If the Wi-Fi coverage is sufficient to do that.
And do you think that's likely to happen in the near future?
Certainly in the centre of town. So the aim would be to look at places like North Street, Market Street, South Street.
Does that not unfairly advantage students who are already paying the high-end rates and actually disadvantage those who are at other ends of the town?
It may be, but you need to bear in mind that some of this is about a commercial extension. What we are doing is extending it on the back of a commercial partnership. And so that has to be taken into account. Now, if, for example, right on the edge of town, there are no businesses that would benefit from it, then a balance has to be struck about whether or not we would, you know, BT, who would be our partner with that, would actually want to put something out there.
Yeah, isn't that the simple truth of it? That BT or any other broadband provider isn't going to want to give free Wi-Fi to all these students who are going to pay them otherwise?
I think that you need to look on the other side of it, and that BT would actually also be gaining access to visitors and tourists. And that's part of the thing that we've been discussing with BT, is the fact that, you know, during the summer, you'll get significant numbers of tourists here, significant number of people who are looking at, you know, taking part in the golf. Those people at the moment are perhaps not getting access, and this might be a chance to give them that access.
OK, I suppose one of the other challenges that people constantly want is studying more remotely on their own and and working through the university's online systems to do that.
Yeah.
And what sort of changes are we seeing happening with that, and people being able to study from home or even study from another country? Could we see degrees being done online before long?
Well, potentially. I mean, it very much depends on what the people in the teaching area of the university, you know, think about that kind of topic. That's not really my sort of area, and I don't really think I'm able to talk about delivering degrees in that way. From a technology point of view, then, it is possible.
The capability is there to
the
do it. So it's purely down to the academic staff to choose whether or not they want to go down that route.
Yeah.
So what other examples of things do you think there are that you currently do that which could actually be done better?
Well, I can give you an example of something that we used to do very badly, and we've certainly improved, and that was around printing. We used to get a lot of complaints about printing, and we've improved that significantly. We're getting a lot of positive feedback about that. We've now put printers in halls of residence, which means that potentially if you're in the library at, say, 1:45 in the morning and you finish your essay and hit a button and have to leave, you've sent it to print. You can then go to your hall of residence and just pick it up from that printer, as opposed to having to stand about in the location where we are. I think, talking about things that we might want to improve, one of the things that I'm quite keen on is looking at how we can give students, from their own personal equipment, more access to the kind of things they need. So we've been working very closely with our partners in the library, for example, to look at how we can improve electronic resource access.
How far is that down to your department, and how far is that down to the library to sort this out?
It's a combination. I mean, quite a lot of resources are already available. Some of them we're trying to make more available. Part of that work requires us on our end to do work on the infrastructure, and then at the other end, our colleagues in the library may well need to do work around, for example, licensing or making sure that the software itself is configured, sorry, the resources themselves are configured properly.
Last week in the news section of the St Andrews webpage, it said that the university has won a 2-star service desk award. What does this actually mean?
So what happens is the Service Desk Institute is an institute that certifies service desks and also provides training and consultancy. So it's an internationally recognised standard. We started the pursuit of this in last year, And one of the things that we were trying to do was actually improve our delivery of service and also benchmark it against an international standard. So we originally go through an initial audit whereby the Service Institute comes in, takes a look at how you meet up against the standards, and then they give you 9 months to then comply with certain standards. So if you don't meet the standards, they say, right, here are the areas for improvement. We then work during the 9 months to meet those standards in the hope of getting at least 2-star certification, which is the minimum certification you can get.
So did you fall quite short at the beginning of that period? Was there a lot that needed changing?
There was, in certain areas we were quite close to the standard, but there were some other areas where we were quite far away. And so quite a lot of work had to be done around that.
And is this a 2-star out of 5-star?
It's the certification goes 2, 3, and 4. There is a 5-star certification, but in order to get a 5-star certification, you have to have had 4-star certification 2 years running.
Okay, so actually, we're still down at the bottom end of this. What more is there that can be done to actually work up it?
Well, following our certification, we then received a list of areas where we could look to improve, and we've already put a programme in place to try and implement as many of these improvements as we can. Our aim at the moment is hopefully in December, when they come for the next audit, to achieve a 3-star certification.
And you think that's perfectly manageable?
With the requisite amount of work, it will be.
I read from the same article on the university website that there are between 2,500 and 5,000 incidents a month logged by your team.
Yeah.
That strikes me as being an awful lot. Is it still a lot? Is that still a huge number of problems there are to deal with, or is that significantly less than it was before?
It's significantly less, but I think you also need to bear in mind that not all of these are problems. Some of these are just simple requests for, you know, can I have access to this software? Can you tell me where I'd find this? Right up to, you know, oh, my laptop's completely broken, and help.
And for students who face problems with their own personal equipment, you raised there, can they go to you for help with that, or would you?
No, they can. We run a service that we refer to as the PC Clinic, which is a paid for service, which is also subsidised by the university, and we'll look at students' personal equipment. We'll make an estimate of how much we think the repairs will cost, and then we give the student an opportunity to say whether they'd like us to carry out the work or not. We've also now begun to open it up to staff within the university. Previously it was students only, but we're now quite confident with the level of work that we can deal with that we moved it on to staff.
Okay, and so moving on again to the wider issues surrounding this, going forward, do you think that actually you're providing the softwares that students need on the system? Do you think that actually the choice of things provided by university IT is what meets the needs of a student of today?
I think that's quite a difficult question, because part of what we offer is actually dictated isn't quite the word I was going to say, but it's decided by the university, because a lot of the software that we're providing is for example for teaching purposes, and because that is within the academic purview, you know, we're then guided by what the staff say that they want. There's also a number of other kind of things that are not related directly to teaching that we may think are useful for students, and we've got a relatively free rein in providing that. However, we're always open to suggestions if students have got ideas for things that would make their life easier.
One of the things that we're seeing now with technology is a move more and more away from desktop PCs and far more towards handheld devices and people's personal devices, which they can do a lot of work from as well. Going forward, how are you preparing for this, and how are you improving the systems to cope with this and work with people's own devices?
Right. I mean, we're doing quite a lot of work in the background around the infrastructure to make sure that people using these kind of devices like tablets and that can get access to what we need. So there might be simple things like looking at the university website to see whether or not we can make it less static and more able to deal with the device. So, for example, if the device has a smaller screen, then the website itself may resize itself to make it more readable. The technology is moving on quite quickly, and I appreciate what you were saying about the desktop part. And one of the things that we've been discussing with various students at the moment is whether or not we need to keep as many fixed desktop PCs, say, for example, in the library. It's something that I kind of, I'm responsible for that area, and I kind of wrestle with quite a lot, because I do see arguments from some people who say, well, actually, what I want is a desktop and power to plug my laptop in so that I can work. But then whenever I go into the library, I see the fixed PCs full. And in fact, at one point early on, when we put more PCs into the library on level 3 and 4, my staff were putting the PCs on desks. But before they could actually plug them in, students were coming in and sitting down at them. So there is a significant demand for them still. And I think feedback on what students want is A, very useful, but B, is actually quite variable, because I've had some students say to me, oh, you can get rid of them, I never used them. But then I've had other students say to me, well, actually, you know, perhaps I can't afford a laptop, or I don't want to carry a laptop about. What I want to do is use my laptop for personal study, and instead I want to sit down at a desk and use a PC to write my essay.
A reminder that you're listening to Alexander Jones Live here on St Andrews Radio. I'm speaking to Kevin Donaghy, the Assistant Chief Information Officer here at the University, and we're discussing the IT systems here. And if you missed any of today's programme, you can hear it as a podcast on the Star website. So, Kevin, going back to the point about people's own devices again, how do you decide which mobile devices you will make software and operate with software that is compatible with, and which ones you'll ignore? So, for example, university Wi-Fi works on smartphones such as an iPhone, but not on a BlackBerry. How do you make that decision which ones you'll use?
Sometimes that decision is taken out of our hands. So the situation with the BlackBerry, for example, is that there's a specific security protocol that is not supported, which is necessary for the university's Wi-Fi system, and is actually necessary for quite a lot of them. And so as a result, sometimes we have no choice but to say, well, actually, we can't get that configured properly.
Yeah, and so more often than not, it's something down to the technology, and you don't look for ways to overcome that necessarily?
There are some workarounds that we can put in place for that, but again, sometimes we have to balance that with, well, will that compromise security?
And so ultimately, security is the main concern above all else?
I wouldn't say quite above all else, but it is one of our primary concerns.
I'll bring in at this stage producer Carla, who is here with us as well, in the studio. And Carla, for students, IT is a big issue, and it's maybe not one that people think about a lot until it goes wrong. And one of the points that Kevin raised was about the new printing system, which was introduced over the summer. How do you think that's going down with students?
I've heard mixed reviews about it. Some people said, you know, what is this? I don't know what this, you know, I don't want to do with this. But I think it was probably more the case that at the start of the year, people don't really like change. So a change in any kind of routine is hard. People now, I mean, that I've heard have said, no, they've made it much easier. I find it much easier personally. You just go up and you swipe and you're sorted. And it's all in one, the sort of way they've consolidated the credits for photocopying and printing and all that kind of stuff. It makes things a lot easier and a lot simpler, I believe.
On that point, the prices did go up, didn't they, when the printing moved to this new system?
No, they didn't.
Double-sided printing did change 5p to 7p? Before it only charged you for a single side, and then afterwards it charged you an extra 2p when you did double-sided.
I don't think so.
I'm pretty sure that that's...
All right, well, right, but I'll need to check.
So, what do you do with the pricing structure? Again, is that decided by your department?
What happened was I put together the pricing structure on the basis of what we did before and also what was comparable around other universities in the country. That then went to the principal's office to check that they were happy enough with the kind of pricing structure and to the sabbaticals at the time. And they were happy enough with it. The one thing I would say about the money that comes out of that is that it goes entirely back into the printing system. We only just cover the costs for the lease of the devices, the paper, the toner.
So that is the exact cost it takes to do it. There's not a profit for your department offer, and there's no subsidising the other way either.
No. There's a very small surplus, which was designed to cover, for example, if we needed any expansion, because at the time we estimated how many devices we needed, but we were not quite clear about whether or not we would have enough. So there's a surplus of about £1,000.
Perhaps one of the issues that comes up most with the printing system, in particular, and other systems as well, when there's change, is, yes, Carla points out people don't necessarily like change, and that's perhaps just human nature. Mm-hmm. But do you think you always communicate this to the best way you could? and that people understand what's going to happen.
I think we've been very poor at that in the past, and I think this year around the printing, we made a very conscious effort. So, for example, we start to do things like send out emails to returning students to say, look, these are the services that have changed, this is how you might encounter them. To new students, we sent them stuff saying, welcome, here's the kind of services you might expect to use. We also put a number of what we refer to as print ambassadors in the library for the first couple of weeks. And these were people that we tasked, these were students who we tasked, we'd trained, and then we tasked with them with being at the printers during the day and assisting students when they came up to use them. And that seemed to be very positively received.
Another element of IT as well that I'd like to raise is actually the staff using it, because so often the students have been brought up in a generation where we're used to using new systems, we're used to adapting to that, how much we might moan about it. Sometimes the staff are the people who struggle more to adapt, and you can see lecturers who don't always understand how to operate all the systems in lecture theatres. What do you do to try and train them and to show them how to use the systems?
Well, we do run training sessions for the staff, but one of the things we're doing at the moment, and as part of the Learning and Teaching Committee process at the moment, is we've put a teaching infrastructure group in place. And that group is trying to look at whether or not the technology that we're providing in teaching rooms is perhaps too complicated, not complicated enough, whether it meets all the requirements. So we're canvassing, students who already sit on that and also academic staff that sit on that.
And what sort of feedback do you get from the academic staff already? Are they happy with what's going on, or are they generally quite negative to you?
I think it's variable. Like all things with, 2,000 academic staff, you get some people who are very happy with it and want more technology and want to teach with things like the clickers. At the other end, you've got some academics who feel more comfortable, for example, with a blackboard and a piece of chalk or an overhead projector. And we're trying to strike a balance there.
Yeah. Carla, I'm just going to quickly return to one of the issues that we raised earlier on about Wi-Fi and the prospect of extending that beyond the university buildings as well. Mm-hmm. What do you think the student reaction would be to that? Would people, I'm guessing people would welcome more Wi-Fi, but what would their reaction be to certain parts of the town having that as available for free and not other parts?
Well, naturally, they'd moan about it. Obviously, it would be very positive, as much as possible. And it is to do with, as Kevin was saying, about how far you can reach the Wi-Fi and how much it benefits the businesses. One thing that's quite good is that I know that you were saying your IT department is working quite hard with the library to try to get electronic resources available. What is it, the idea if you're in Australia or you're in Scotland, it doesn't matter. But it's still, in my experience and in others' experience, and even from the library staff themselves, it's still quite a tricky business to sort of like go on and make sure that you can access those. And so that might be something. I mean, obviously it can only be beneficial. You could argue, accommodation in this place, as we've talked about before, as is always talked about, is a tricky business. And you could argue that people who are living in town in the very expensive properties have perhaps more money to spend on their own internet. Maybe it's the people who are living farther out, for the cheaper accommodation wherever they can get it, right on the edge of town, who would perhaps benefit from that being stretched out. But it's a tricky one to do. It's obviously best to benefit as many people as possible, no matter where they may be.
On that income note about people and the differences between those who can maybe afford to live in the centre of town and those further out, and there is a real issue here with people being able to afford to come to St Andrews. It's an expensive place to come, and what support can IT provide to people who maybe don't have personal devices, and they can be so important for actually getting your work done? What support can you provide?
Well, I think this comes back to one of the discussions we had about the kind of use of desktop computers compared to laptops, and we're trying to provide as many facilities as we can for students so that they can actually study, in the library, for example, or in some of the classrooms. I'd also just say that going back to the PC clinic, the price for the repairs is actually heavily subsidised. So if you went commercially to get, for example, your laptop repaired, it would be quite expensive.
Kevin, thank you for joining us on the programme today. That's Kevin Donaghy, the Assistant Chief Information Officer at the University. And this is Alexander Jones Live. You're listening to On Star. Still to come up before the end of this programme, we'll be discussing about Islam. The faith is this week holding an awareness week in St Andrews, and I'll be speaking to a member of that society in just a moment. He'll be telling us what he believes and about the role that Islam has to play in today's world. And of course, remember that you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Mr Jones News. But now, it's a busy news week. And I can't guarantee what you'll hear now, so you might break my golden rule, but I promise we'll return to it when we get back. Here is the 5:30 Star News.
UN Security Council passes new sanctions on North Korea.
Fife Local to undertake charity cycle from Cairo to Cape Town.
Live from Star Studios, this is Star News.
With the 5:30 Star News, I'm Candace Stevenson.
And I'm Susanna Sabin. A quick reminder that voting for university elections is now live online and around town. Voting for all positions closes tomorrow at 6 p.m. with the results announced later that evening.
The United Nations Security Council has approved new sanctions against North Korea after the country performed its third nuclear test. The resolution, drafted by the United States, was approved unanimously by the 15-nation council today. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon praised the move, which is intended to crack down on North Korea's attempts to ship and receive banned cargo in breach of previous UN sanctions.
The Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at the University of St. Andrews is set to expand its work as the result of a generous donation from the Worldwide Support for Development, a nonprofit chaired by Japanese philanthropist Dr. Haruhisa Handa. The CSTPV, based in the School of International Relations, is Europe's oldest center for the study of terrorism. Dr. Handa's gift will, quote, ensure that St. Andrews in Scotland will continue to be preeminent in this critical field of research, unquote, according to Principal Louise Richardson. Along with the donation, the CSTPV will soon take the name of its benefactor and become the Handa Center.
Fife local Jack White is planning to bike the length of Africa from Cairo, Egypt to Cape Town, South Africa, in order to raise money for the charity Farm Africa. The charity combats hunger in Eastern Africa by educating small farmers about sustainably producing more food. White's journey, beginning in April, will span 8,700 miles, run through 12 countries, and span several different landscapes, including desert, rainforest, and savanna. White left his job at the Royal and Ancient in late February and is currently preparing for the trip, putting himself through a grueling fitness routine. You can follow Jack's progress on his website at jackcyclesafrica.com.
Plans have been put forward to renovate the White Melville Memorial Fountain. The fountain, which currently crowns the center of Market Street, was erected as a fully functional fountain in 1880, but has since fallen into disrepair. Although discussions on the annual maintenance are ongoing, £18,500 have been deposited in the St. Andrews Common Good Fund to refurbish the fountain and bring it back to full working order.
And finally, the weather. Mainly dry at first, with a few clear spells, some rain and wind overnight. Tomorrow, cloudy with rain and snow on higher ground, bitterly cold with a strong easterly wind.
And those are today's headlines. For more news, tune into our bulletin tomorrow at 5:30 or online anytime on the news section of the Star website.
Welcome back to Alexander Jones Live. Before the break, I was speaking to Kevin Donaghy, the Assistant Chief Information Officer for the university. He was telling us about the IT systems. And if you did miss any of that interview due to the problems at the start of the hour, then it will be available as a whole as a podcast on the Star website. That will be just after the end of today's programme. So here in St Andrews this week, it is Islamic Awareness Week. The Islamic Society are organising a number of events to explain their beliefs. And here in the studio, I'm joined by Tahir Aslam from the Society. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
So, if you can maybe begin for us by actually just explaining the basics of the Islamic faith and your personal story of how you came to believe in it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Regarding what is Islam, Islam means peace. Well, that's where Islam comes from. And it means like giving, submitting your will to Allah. And if you want to know the basics of Islam, there are six articles of faith, which is believing in one unity, faith in unity of God, and faith in prophets, faith in angels, and faith in the books, the revelation of books of Revelation, faith in the day of judgment, and also faith in destiny. And so these are the six articles of Islam. Regarding the five pillars of Islam, first one is the Shahada, which is like declaring yourself like La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah, like there's no God but Allah, and Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is the last messenger of Allah, of the God. And the second pillar of Islam is the Salat, which is translating in English means prayer. Third one is Zakat, which is charity. You give 2.5% of your annual income if you qualify. And the fourth one is Al-Sawm, which means fasting. So that's like the month of Ramadan. And the last one is Hajj, which is a Muslim pilgrimage. They go to Saudi Arabia for Mecca.
And what personally led you to believe in Islam? Were you brought up in a Muslim family?
Yeah, I was born and raised in a Muslim family. I am from Pakistan. So, I mean, I had a cultural aspect as well. But just because you're born in Islam does not mean you have to take Islam as your religion. Islam actually encourages, like, people asking questions and the reasoning behind it. Like, why should I embrace Islam? I mean, we had a talk last night as well by Dr. Ali, and he did explain it very nicely, like, why should we embrace Islam? Talk was applicable not just to non-Muslims, but it was to Muslims as well. Even though we are born and raised in Muslim Islam and its culture, we still need to go and explore why should we believe in Islam.
And was there a moment for you when you decided, yes, I do believe in this?
Well, thing is, any time I have any doubt or any questions, I mean, I've never had, like, I always knew, like, there has to be a God. Like, all these things in the universe can't just be, like, created out of nothing. There has to be some entity. And any time I have any questions or anything, they were, like, answered. And that means I couldn't find any flaw or anything in the religion I was brought up in. So that made me, like, okay, Islam is the good choice.
So have you explored other religions to see what they have to say as well? Have you actually, you said about how Islam mm-hmm. encourages asking questions.
Yeah. About Islam, like, why should you embrace Islam? Yeah.
Yeah, and have you gone through that process yourself of actually critically looking at it to see what it really has to say?
Well, as I mentioned, I have been brought up and raised, so I have, like, in daily, day-to-day life, everything made perfect sense to me. So
it was really just a logical conclusion to move
If I ask you, like, if you're walking, using your logic, reasoning and common sense, if you're, like, walking in a desert and out of nowhere you find a mobile phone, like, would you believe it's possible? It's not. It's like someone has to, like, create it or something. It's too complex, in other words. So the whole universe and everything is too complex to be just out of nothing. Someone had to be there to make it.
I'm really interested by a few of the words that you brought up at mm-hmm. the start in your explanation of Islam, so I'm just going to mm-hmm. throw them back to you and okay. ask you a few questions about that. So the first one is peace. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if we're looking at the world today, we see where this is going. Yeah. Is Islam bringing peace to the world?
Well, that's the thing. Those who are saying and doing all these things in the name of Islam, I don't consider them, like, they're following Islam. I don't consider them following Islam.
Is that just a Western understanding of Islam, though, or is that something that you think people in the Middle East, in countries where this is going on, would they agree with you on that?
With what?
Your point that that they're not actually doing this under as Muslims, that that really what you're doing here is that's what the Quran says. Do you think that all Muslims, all real Muslims, mm-hmm. would agree with that you said?
Well, if they are following teachings of Islam and Quran, then they would know, like, killing an innocent human being is wrong. So doesn't justify what, I mean, as you're saying, the extremists, etc., but so it doesn't justify what they are doing.
Okay, the next word, unity. Mm-hmm. How much unity do we see among Muslims in the world?
Well, the best example I could think of it right now is that if you go to Hajj, the pilgrimage over there, the whole idea over there is that it doesn't matter whether you are rich or poor with color, ethnicity, wherever you're from. Everyone dresses up in the same white piece of cloth, and everyone sits together, eats together, prays together, everything. So it doesn't matter if you're a king or, you know, like, any, doesn't matter whatever you are. So it's all unity. So, I mean, I was reading earlier on as well about the unity, and Malcolm X, when he went to pilgrimage, and then the thing most fascinated him, that's what he said about him, like, about the Hajj as well, the unity, the whole brotherhood over there.
Have you been on the pilgrimage yourself yet?
Actually, no, I have not, but I will try to go. I am going for Umrah, which is not main Hajj pilgrimage, but it's the smaller version. I'm going actually on this Tuesday, so I'm going to leave soon.
Okay. Is that for the break, for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, in the Easter break, yeah. I'm going with my parents.
So what role do you think that Islam should play in politics then? Do you think that there should be a complete separation of your individual faith and the state, or should there be something far wider than that?
What? Can you explain more?
Yeah, should Islam uh-huh. have a role in politics? Should it be in government? Should government have a religion?
Well, it depends how you look at it. For example, if your government is applying teachings, like, for example, take UK, for example. You know how we have in UK the benefits and all, you know, like, having a standard set for quality of life, the council benefits and all these things. And Islam actually does say all these things. We may have a welfare in the social life as well. So if you are thinking of this way, you are kind of applying Islam in the religion as well.
So you're more taking the ideas of Islam and then putting them on government, as opposed to actually looking at and maybe applying Sharia law to your entire country. Do you think that would be a good idea?
Well, you are mentioning Sharia law, but do you explain, like, what Sharia law is then before I answer?
Do you want to explain to me what your understanding of Sharia law is?
I mean, I know, I mean...
So we've got that clear.
Thing is, no... I mean, I want to say, you know, like, how Westerners think of Sharia law is, like, something, like, whoa, if you steal something, they'll, like, amputate your hand, they'll chop off your arms and all that. I mean, it is true, but thing is, it's more of a, like, scaring someone. It's like a threat. I mean, you know that, okay, if I do that, my hand will get chopped off, like, it will get amputated. You will never do that. It's to scare someone, and it's to also to make, like, a, what is it called? I can't think of the word. Just lost the word.
But if that was applied to government, then people who didn't believe in Islam, if they stole something, and that was...
No, the thing is, Sharia law... No, but Sharia law is only applicable to Muslims, though. It's only applicable to Muslims. So if a Muslim does it, only then he can undergo under Sharia law. But non-Muslims will have their civil law.
Do you think that it's possible to have this relationship between religion and government where actually a religion makes up a load more rules for its followers? So would it be possible, for instance, for the Muslims in the UK to decide to enforce that? Do you think that that would be a...
Well, thing is, UK is not a Muslim country, so we, as Muslims, we are obliged to live by the law of the land. So we can't, like, go out and force, like, Islamic laws. We are living, actually, under the laws of UK.
But is it right that a state would enforce those rules in everywhere? So if a state was a Muslim country, the UK did become a Muslim country, presumably even in a Muslim country, not every single person is a Muslim. So is it right that they then enforce those rules on everyone?
I mean, the best way I could answer that question is, if you look in the past, you know, in looking in the Arab world, because my history is not very strong, I'm more of a medicine science guy, but looking in the past, in the Arab world, there were quite a lot of churches, and there were Christians, Jews, everyone lived together as well, even though it was the Muslim governments, etc. So, I don't know if that answers your question. Well, you can live together.
Yeah, so, but you can live together without actually having the state taking a side. So the state would remain neutral between the religions, is that right? So could a state take, like you could say we have in the UK at the moment, the state hasn't got any religion, and then the church, say, for Christians and individual mosques for Muslims, they would then have freedoms to do what they want.
Yeah.
But would you then allow individual religions to choose laws for their people in addition to that, so be able to enforce chopping off the hand or whatever else it is?
Well, that's what I was trying to tell you as well. Like, those who are Muslims, the laws follows, like, Sharia law will be applicable to Muslims only, whereas others will be in the civil just. I'm confused with the question. Like,
so the state needs to adopt that, but then say it only applies to Muslims?
Yeah.
Okay.
As far as my knowledge, but I'm not a scholar, so you can't take my word. I'm just going to clear myself and, like, yeah, make a safety loop for myself.
Do you think that Islam and democracy can be compatible?
Well, it depends how you define democracy. If, like, if Abraham Lincoln said, like, democracy is the government of people, by people, for people. So, if you're looking at it this way, anyone can become a leader in Islamic world, and by the people. So there's like a council as well, which is called Shura, which advises like what we should do, what we should not do, etc. And the last one is the for the people. So the whole beneficial concept of the providing a good social support, etc., for the society.
Yeah, so it is possible, you think, because if we're looking at the Middle East, again, the region where Islam is by far at its strongest, we're not seeing many successful democracies, and we'll take democracy as meaning a few freedoms and the right to vote and elect your government, is, I suppose, the key part of it. We're not seeing many of them emerge in Islamic countries. You don't see any link between saying no to democracy and being a Muslim?
Well, actually, as I mentioned, my knowledge in politics is actually not very strong, so I can't answer on other countries, etc.
So, but you personally wouldn't have a problem living in a democracy and being, like, well,
yeah,
you live in the UK, and that's not a problem.
Yeah.
In the UK, what role would you like to see Islam play?
Could you elaborate more a bit?
Yeah. So, would you like Islam to be? Well, I'm presuming you want it to be larger, and that you would like more people to be Muslims. But would you like Muslims to have more influence over government? Would you like us to be moving to more back to Sharia law again? Would you like us to be moving towards a Sharia law system when that was law for Muslims? Would you like more schools to be based on Islamic teaching?
Well, the thing is, as you mentioned, UK is a democratic country, so you have to consider the percentage-wise the ratio of what people want. So there are quite a lot of Islamic schools as well in UK, like in England side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you're quite happy with the situation as it is at the moment?
Yeah. I mean, I've never experienced anything bad, so...
What's life like as a Muslim here in St Andrews? Do you find it particularly difficult, or is it quite easy to hold your faith and be a student here?
I think it's pretty easy. It's very, very comfortable here.
Yeah. Do you find that a lot of other students challenge you? Atheists, for example, do they challenge you a lot about your beliefs?
The thing is, they don't, like, come to you on your face-to-face and, like, why are you Muslim and nothing like that. But we do have an interfaith group, and we're starting a new thing called Question Time, which will be happening 1 or 2 weeks after the Easter holidays. So there's, like, proper, like, system, like a channel you can have, like, proper debates, etc., like interface, as I mentioned. But nothing like they come to your face and, like, why are you Muslim? Or, like, why are you doing that? Etc., no.
I mentioned at the start that you're from the Islamic Society. Uh-huh. So how big's the Islamic Society? What sort of things do you do?
Islamic Society is... I mean, the thing is, in the whole St Andrews, it's just... The town itself is just mostly populated by students anyway. And the Muslim community, I would say, as far as I know, is about 100 to 150 Muslim students. I mean, as far as I know. And what was the other part of the question?
So how many people are there, and what sort of things do you do in the society?
Regarding the events we do in society, we actually do like quite a lot of events, from social events to Islamic events. Like, in social events, we... do like barbecue or like breakfast event or like potluck dinners, where everyone, like, since I'm an Islamic society, We've got people from different ethnic backgrounds, so everyone cooks something from their background, and then they bring us, like, we actually have tonight as well, potluck dinner. We're having it tonight. So that's, like, one of, like, the social aspects of what we do. Regarding the Islamic aspect, we do, like, talks, knowledge circles, Islamic cafes, like, a discussion-based. And, yeah, there are training sessions.
Are there a lot of people from different backgrounds there? The people from different cultures who have different aspects of Islam to bring together into that? So, day-to-day, the Muslim life, if I can, the question parts of that, how do you go about praying? How do you find... fit that round your lectures and class?
Well, first of all, the first prayer is in the morning, Fajr, just a sunrise one, which you do before sunrise. So, I mean, sunrise nowadays is about like 6:50 in the morning, so you can just pray in your room before the lectures anyway. And regarding the Zohar, which is around the afternoon, there's a lunchtime break from 1 to 2, so we can just come to Mansfield to pray. And then Asr, the third one, is kind of like in the late afternoon. You can, if you have lectures, like back-to-back lectures, let's say from 3 to 6, whatever, there's usually, like, after a lecture, there's, like, a 5-10 minutes break, and we can just pray, like, one of the... I'm a medical student, so we can just pray in one of the tutorial rooms we have over there. But anytime, we can just come to Mansfield or any place. It works out.
Do you find comfortable. That... with being in Scotland, the early morning one, sunrise gets earlier and earlier, does that... Do you have to get up earlier and earlier with that?
Yeah, the thing is, it gets so early that the time comes that in summer it's around like 2:30 or 3 or something. So for that, what we do is just, we just don't sleep. So we just like stay away and like chill. For example, last year, I lived in David Russell apartment. So it was me and my other four friends, and all five of us were Muslims. So we used to just like chill and like play Monopoly, etc. or maybe like read Quran and then just go for Fajr and pray Fajr and then sleep after. Because, like, coming at 2:30, so you can't really wake in the middle of the night. It's just, so you can... It works out.
And I guess, do you get together with other Muslims in a mosque scenario at some point? Do you travel to a mosque somewhere?
Well, St. Andrews doesn't have any mosque, so it's only have an Islamic Society prayer room in Mansfield. But regarding going to mosques, etc., I mean, I live in Glasgow. I'm just here for the term time address. So in Glasgow, there are quite a lot of mosques. In fact, there are 3 mosques in my own street in Glasgow. So Glasgow actually got a very big population of Muslims.
But when you're actually here, you don't have a mosque that you go to. The Islamic Society is sort of your entire basis for getting around with people from your faith as well.
Yeah, and also, but thing is, well, one main part of the mosque is that you do Friday congregation prayers, and we have an imam who comes from Dindi, Imam Wali. So he comes from Dindi every Friday to lead a congregational prayer in Mansfield.
And do you find that generally the university are very supportive of you, and that other students are very understanding of things like getting
the prayer at the right time?
You find that you can actually you can express your faith to other people as well.
Yeah, I've never experienced any problem. Yeah, everyone is very understanding. Yeah,
yeah. You mentioned that Glasgow has quite a lot of Muslims. Yeah. Do you feel very outnumbered here? Does it feel like it's just a very small number of you, and that you're fighting through everything else?
No, actually not. No, I don't feel. Thing is, because it's got a small number here, it's. Just because it's got a small number here, it's actually more closely linked. And I actually know, like, I would say, majority of the Muslims in St. Andrews. So actually, we are actually more linked together, I guess, this way, in this aspect, I would say.
Another point is you're a medic. And do you find that your faith has any implications on your work as a medic, on your studies there?
I don't see why it would have any, like, implications or anything. Like, you're treating, like, sick people, so it's actually good.
Is it really a driving factor in actually making you want to do that?
What my faith has been?
Your faith, is that something that really makes you want to be a medic? Was that important in making you...
Well, to be honest, I never actually thought about becoming a doctor regarding faith aspect. I just thought, like, you have the grades, why not? why not just be a medic? Why not?
A well-chosen career, I'm sure. I'll bring in again producer Carla, who we heard from earlier in the programme. And Carla, we do have a wide range of faiths here in St Andrews, and the interfaith work here is reasonably strong and it's growing. How important do you think that dialogue is between the faiths that's going on?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's imperative for a place like this, particularly with more people. I mean, we talk about the UK, and you were just saying that people in, you know, there's three mosques on your street in Glasgow. You know, the UK is not just a Christian dominated place as it might have been before. We've got people from all over the world coming, with all kind of faiths, or indeed no faith at all. Which is something I know the Interfaith Society acknowledges too. It's not just the major world religions and other smaller religions, but it's also atheism too. I think that's important in our understanding, because the idea is that's why it's important for everybody to be educated, I think, at all stages of your life, of how to get along with people and celebrate other people's faiths and religions. I think it's a great thing that we endeavour to do that.
One of the really interesting things about being a student here is just how willing people are to discuss faith and to discuss their views on various things. Is that something, you're nodding, so I'm guessing that's something that the Islamic society find as well. And Carla, do you think that's a product of the society that we live in, that people are really interested in hearing what the different ideas are about, or is that a unique thing for this town?
I'm not 100% sure on that. Mostly I'm going to have to say that I think it's a St Andrews thing, because we are so, you know, varied in, you know, the kind of people that we have from everywhere. I mean, I was at a tutorial today and we were talking about journeys and the idea of traveling away from your home, for example. And, we said, has anyone traveled away from home? And of course, all seven or eight of us, none of us were from Scotland. So I think, and never mind St Andrews. So I think that this is a place, you know, if you come to somewhere, you know, a university environment, people, I think, who want to go on and go to university have a habit of wanting to ask questions, you know, wanting to find out more than is necessary to just get by. And I mean, I speak from, you know, from where, you know, my family back home, or like other people that, I mean, I happen to know the older generations particularly don't know that much about a religion that's not theirs, and even at times not even about their own. So I would have to say, as far as I know, I think St Andrews is probably unique in that aspect, unfortunately, because it would be lovely if the world round were that way.
Tahir, one of the things that has come up several times in this discussion has been the interfaith work that's going on. And do you really want to tell us a bit about that and about the Islamic Society's role in it?
Well, from Islamic Society, I'm not actually leading the interfaith myself. It's one of the other person in the committee who's leading the interfaith. But, yeah, the events take place when different religions come and they tell about their religions, and just trying to increase the understanding of each other's religion, like what is Islam, what is Christianity, what is Judaism, etc.
And what sort of events are going on? You mentioned the question time between...
That's going to be a new event. It's going to have Atheist Society, Christian, Catholic Society, and Jewish Society, Islamic Society, and possibly Eastern Religion Society as well. Yeah, so all these societies are joining together to do the question time event.
And this, as well as the Islamic Society and the Christian Union here, is really large as well. What do you find with relations with the smaller faiths as well? Do they really chip into it? And are there significant numbers of people following the smaller faiths that you come across as well?
To be honest, I actually don't really have any idea about the other societies, like about the numbers they have. I don't really have much idea about them.
Yeah. Do you come across a lot of people with different religious views? I'm not just thinking of people who are atheists or agnostics or Christians, but do you come across people with other beliefs as well that traditionally wouldn't be associated with people in this country?
No, I don't think so.
No. But do you think that as well, so you've said you've come across a lot of Muslims here. Is that something unique to you being part of the Islamic
Society. I think that is because of it, yeah.
Yeah,
because I'm the president of Islamic Society, so anytime I see someone walking by and I just greet them, etc., and then try to involve them in Islamic Society.
Yeah, and for a lot of students, you don't think that necessarily they would come across a lot of Muslims as well. Is that something that you're trying to change? What sort of outreach things are you trying to do?
Well, we are trying to hold like social events, etc. So, like, I'm trying to encourage the whole, not just the Muslims, non-Muslims to come to our events as well. So, on our events, there's actually like quite a lot of non-Muslims who attend our events as well. So, trying to just like try to create like nice like family feeling to St. Andrews. I mean, I know it's like all outsiders. So, like, it's all like students from, they've left their home and they're coming here. We're just trying to create like a family in St. Andrews. That's what we're trying to do in Islamic Society. It's like providing a family. ISOC as Islamic Society as like a family, basically.
Finally, I said at the start of this interview that it is Islamic Awareness Week here. Yeah. Do you want to just tell us what events are still to come and what people can go along to if they're interested?
Well, Islam Awareness Week is actually from Monday to Friday, and it's just like today is the second last day, and at 6:30 today we are having our potluck dinner, our very famous potluck dinner where everyone comes for the food, and it's along with Islamic quiz as well, just because of Islam Awareness Week, so we're having a theme of Islamic quiz. So there's going to be some questions about Islam, and the winning team will get a prize as well. So that's in Mansfield right now. The whole STAR team and anyone who's listening to radio right now is more than welcome. We warmly invite all of you. And tomorrow we are having a talk in Court School 1, and the topic is multiculturalism and coexistence with Islam. So, and the speaker is Dr. Al-Haghi. He's coming from Dundee. So, and so again, and everyone is really, really invite everyone, like especially the non-Muslims, because it is essentially Islam Awareness Week. So we're trying to raise like people aware about Islam. So I would really invite everyone for that as well.
Tahir, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And on the programme today, we have been discussing the university's IT systems with the Associate Chief Information Officer, Kevin Donaghy, and you've just heard me speaking to Tahir Aslam from the Islamic Society about Islamic Awareness Week, which finishes tomorrow. And here is the final mention of it, a reminder that elections are currently open, and you can vote between now and 6 p.m. tomorrow. Over 3,000, is it 2,000, 3,000 we're up now? There's a high turnout currently, so do get voting. I'm Alexander Jones. Thank you for listening to the programme. I'll be back again at the same time next week.
Tune in to STAR, University of St. Andrews radio station.
St. Andrews' only radio station.
This is STAR.
Contact us here at the studio by buzzing the studio from www.standrewsradio.com.